Popol Vuh, ending today's program. That's still them. The late, great Florian Schneider. Einsjager und Siebenjager is the name of this release from 1974. Kleiner Krieger was the name of the very brief track we just heard. Behind us now is King Minos. Hayden Pettigo, gorgeous guitar track called Long Pond Lily, from a release on Mexican Summer this year called I'll Be Waving As You Drive Away. Harvard Volden, great Swedish guitar player. Love this record, Small Lives, the track we heard called Soaring. We heard Willie Lane before that with Ryan Jewell playing drums with him there on Bobcat Turnaround. The track was called Plant Life. John Fahey and his orchestra from 1972's Of Rivers and Religion. We heard Texas and Pacific Blues. Glenn Jones before that from his 2011 release The Wanting. We heard Even to Win is to Fail. And at the top of the set, a nice little instrumental piece from Country Joe McDonald from his 1972 release on Vanguard called Incredible Live. And did I say the name of the track? Was Walkin' Santiago? I can't remember. I think I did. Wasn't long ago. Anyway, my name is Scott. I thank you for being here with me today, everybody. I look forward to seeing you next week. And I do implore you to stay tuned for Mark Hurst's Tectonic, which is coming right your way, right here on Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU in Mount Hope, in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM, and online at WFMU.org. Bye.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the next hour. It's great to have you here. Thanks for joining. I've got a great episode for you, which I'm going to tell you about in a second. But first, I wanted to say thanks to Sarah Clemens and Stu Horvath for filling in last week, doing a great job, and guest Brendan Keough. That was a really interesting conversation about games. And if you're interested, go into the archives and take a listen. This week, I've got a great interview for you with Webb Keene. He's got a new book out called Animals, Robots, Gods, Adventures in the Moral Imagination. And before I play this, it would probably be good for me to explain a little bit about this book, because just hearing Animals, Robots, Gods, what's going on? It's a book about ethics and morals, which he pretty much collapses into one idea, which he writes about it in the book, that he was not going to distinguish between those two. And thinking about morals and ethics with respect to technology, you might think, is this going to be relevant? Is it going to be interesting? I can assure you this is well worth listening to, because I can guarantee you big tech is interested in these topics. They are baking ethical decisions, or maybe I should say unethical decisions, into their exploitative platforms every day. And those decisions affect you because they cascade to all of the companies and organizations that make use of big tech platforms and algorithms that have these decisions baked inside. So I'm talking finance, healthcare, employers, the justice system. Take your pick. Everywhere you go, there are algorithms and there are pieces and parts of computer code that have ethical decisions made by engineers, product managers, executives, and leaders in Silicon Valley that are determining the course of your life in each of those moments. And so how the tech industry encodes ethics and morality in its products affects you. It affects your family and your community every day. And so it's really important that we talk about it, that we dive into it a little bit. And I'm glad that we have this book written by Webb Keene to give us a viewpoint, an entry into that conversation. I'm going to go ahead and play this interview now with Webb Keene, author of Animals, Robots, Gods, here on Tectonic. Webb Keene, welcome to Tectonic.
Thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you on the show. You're a professor of anthropology at the University of Michigan and the author of a new book I liked a lot. It's called Animals, Robots, Gods, Adventures in the Moral Imagination. It's published by Princeton University Press. You're writing here about new frontiers in morals and ethics developing around robots and AI. And I guess we could say some very old frontiers, since, as you point out, many of the questions we're asking about robot and AI ethics are just versions of very old questions. But why don't we start with some context? Why is it important for us to grapple with ethics and morality? Because Silicon Valley would seem to prefer for us just to accept whatever it creates and not ask those questions.
Well, I think that the short answer to that question, Mark, is that actually we are human beings. And one of the distinctive features of human beings is that we make value judgments all the time. They may be trivial matters of taste at times. They may be very big ones having to do with life and death. But we are not, in fact, neutral, rational calculators. We cannot help but go through life with some underlying sense of what we ought to do in any given situation and the kind of person that we feel we ought to be. But very few people perhaps bracketing the folks you're thinking of in Silicon Valley, very few people go through life utterly unaware of or indifferent to core matters of value and of judgment. Who should I be? Who are you to me? Who should I be to you? Should I take a bribe? Why not? All sorts of things like that. I'm a professor. I have to, should I give in to the student who demands that their A minus be raised to an A? Why not? Wouldn't it be easier if I just did? Why do I care about that? So that's part of an answer to your question, I hope.
Yes, and you also make the case in this book that the stakes are a lot higher now as technologies like robots and AI and all the platforms and products coming off of those are drawing on ethical, or as the case may be, unethical underpinnings that have real effects on people's lives. So it's not simply should the professor raise the grade from an A minus to an A for the demanding student.
And it's always the A minus student. It's never the C student.
It's not simply that. Those questions from time immemorial, humans with decision-making power have faced. Now, increasingly, real-life decisions are being made at great speed by these automated technologies, and often the outcomes are unfair in some way, and we have to ask, what was the ethical standpoint of the person or the team who put that together?
Right. There are many sort of aspects to that question that I could address. I guess the first one, and the one that I think a lot of people have talked about, is just the way in which biases are built into the programming, not just of AI, but sort of any algorithm, to the extent that every algorithm is the product of design decisions. It is necessarily shaped by the assumptions that underlie those decisions, the assumptions, and those assumptions are made by people. They're made by people in very specific social, with specific social statuses, social identities, in particular cultural backgrounds, in particular political situations. So they are never neutral. And they are never, if the word objective even means anything in this context, they cannot be objective. So bias is an inherent property of any decision that's made, and any design is based on people making decisions. So even before we get to the question of AI, this is simply a fundamental feature of algorithms. Now, having said that, lots of people have pointed out all the kinds of biases that are built into algorithms because of very poor programming decisions. I mean, they're very well-known cases. You don't need me to tell you about these. Here's an example. I think it comes from Amazon, and that is there was an algorithm designed for hiring. And the idea was, well, let's look at the data on who succeeded in the corporation in the past, and then we'll take that data and feed it in to prospective hires and see who best matches the data of people who've been successful in the past. Guess what? It tended to favor straight white males. Now, is this a good predictor of future success, or is this in fact not a prediction, but rather a reflection of the kinds of decisions that managers were making in a previous generation? Well, I think the answer is obvious. This is not an objective measure of the potential for success. It is, in fact, a reflection of very human decision making in the past. Now, so what, you may ask? You say, well, we could correct for this. And then people have been trying to correct for this. But there are two points I want to make. And one is that you can't correct for bias all the way down. There's an expression in anthropology that's turtles all the way down, because it's an inherent property of human decision making. The second point is we forget this when we outsource judgment to an algorithm or to a device or to an AI on the grounds that we think that, unlike us, it is objective. So the real danger here is if you know that people are biased, then you can start to take that into account. you can start to negotiate. You can start to disagree with them. The danger comes from this growing practice of outsourcing judgment to devices on the assumption that they are somehow more objective than we are. And that objectivity is, to a very large extent, a phantasm.
That's right. Throughout the book, you're drawing on field work from other anthropologists. And as I mentioned before, you are an anthropology professor. And you repeatedly make the point that the findings and the conclusions that you draw from the findings have to be taken holistically. You have to take them in context. And so when we're looking at any conclusions about an ethical code in a particular culture, we have to understand that culture, because there is not one calculus, as you put at the end of the book, that is going to fit every single human situation, culture, and society. And I was really happy that you brought up as one of your examples or test cases this idea of the trolley problem. The trolley problem, for anyone who has read tech ethics books and articles, you've probably seen mention of the trolley problem. For people who haven't heard it, basically, it's an abstract thought experiment. Let's say you're standing at a switch on a trolley rail line, and if you don't touch the switch, the trolley is going to run over five people who are tied to the tracks. But if you want to save them, you can throw the switch. You can actively make a decision to redirect the trolley, and it'll go away from the five people. But there's one person bound to the tracks that it'll roll over and kill. And so the question is, what's better, to do nothing and not involve yourself, even though five people will die? Or is it better to get involved and take an action, even though by doing that, you will effectively condemn one person to death? Modern day philosophers and an awful lot of computer programmers have debated the trolley problem endlessly. I've always felt uncomfortable with this entire thought experiment, but I couldn't quite put into words why I didn't like it, but you did. You write about an anthropologist named Maurice Bloch, who you write has spent a lifetime of repeated field work in Madagascar with Malagasy villagers. Webb, can you tell us, why did the trolley problem come up in Maurice Bloch's field work in Madagascar, and what was the conclusion there?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, Mark. May I add the one interesting wrinkle to the trolley problem?
Oh, please.
Which is, if you ask people, well, should I throw the switch? And if I throw the switch, one person will be killed. If I don't throw the switch, five people will be killed. And so the calculus is obvious. I can save four lives by killing one person. That is what a classic utilitarian response would be. But if that's the case, why shouldn't a doctor with a sick patient kill them and harvest their organs so that they can be transplanted and save many more people than that one person, right? But when Maurice Bloch tried this out with people, the Malagasy, they thought it was a ridiculous question, because it made no sense to them, because they don't know who these people are and they don't know what their relationships are. And you might say, well, the rational calculus is exactly the same no matter what. But in real life, that's not the case. So let's take real life. Whether you're talking about, you know, us folks here in the U.S. or you're talking about villages in Madagascar, with some very, very rare exceptions, we are not normally in situations of complete and total anonymity where there is no past and there is no future. So part of the artificiality of the trolley problem is that it takes as sort of an attempt to put a foundation under your ethical judgments, a world in which people are completely autonomous and have no relationships with one another. I don't know who those people are. They don't know who I am. And we have no past together, and there is no future. So nothing follows after those people have been saved or not saved, as the case may be, after the poor schmuck on the other track has been run over. Nothing follows. And there's no past before. So the Malagasy people are asking us to consider, are some of those people people who matter to me in certain ways. Should that factor in? Should it matter whether one of them happens to be my mother? Should I just refuse to take that into consideration? If I do, what kind of person am I? Does it matter that I'm going to have to live with their survivors, let's say the rest of their family, the rest of my life? Does that matter? Should I care about that? Now, at the end of the day, you may decide, no, the calculus still holds. But what the folks that Maurice Bloch was talking to are asking us to think about is, don't take these situations outside of the social relations in which they take place. And I guess I'll have to say there was a subtext here that I perhaps should have made more explicit in the book and didn't. And that is the following. Silicon Valley has become enamored of a particular style of ethical thinking called effective altruism. It's like a giant trolley problem. It's saying, what algorithm could I use to calculate the best possible ethical decisions today in the long run? And I mean really the long run, like 1,000 years from now. What the consequences of a decision now? Is it going to save the most animal species or the most human beings or the most planets in the long run? And if I can get my calculation right, then anything I do today to further those ends is justified because the ultimate result is so great, is so mathematically, predictably better than the bad consequences of my decisions today. The most famous proponent of this ethical approach, by the way, his name is Sam Bankman-Fried. So listeners may remember Sam Bankman-Fried was the hedge fund, the very, very young hedge fund billionaire who went to prison for defrauding his investors. He did it in part because he was following this reasoning. It's okay to defraud my investors today because I'm going to use it for some really good thing. Now, you might say, well, you know, he made some bad choices and he should have thought twice about what he was doing. But there's a fundamental problem here that's built back to the trolley problem. And that is the idea that there is only one way to measure ethical value. And we can get the calculations right. This appeals, by the way, the ethical effective altruism tends to appeal to people who think they're smarter than all the rest of us. They're really good at math and statistics. And therefore, we should hand over the most important ethical decision making to them and shut up and just get out of the way. It appeals to people who are really very proud of their IQs. Here's just one problem with that. It assumes that all ethical decisions can be measured along a single spectrum. Let's go back to the little scenario I gave you earlier. Should I give that student an A instead of an A minus? My life would be easier because they wouldn't nag me. Maybe their parents wouldn't harass me. Maybe, who knows, maybe they'd even pay me a nice bribe. I've had to say in 30 years of teaching, no one's ever offered me a nice bribe. But yeah, you can imagine this might happen. And should I do it? Well, that's a decision I make as a professor. Now, the problem is I'm also making decisions over the course of the day as a father. And I'm also making decisions as a citizen, a voter, a taxpayer, a homeowner, a car driver. There is no way to make all those decisions, to measure all those decisions against one another along a single spectrum, because they are qualitatively different. They are asking me to act in different social roles with different kinds of consequences. You can't just line them up according to one metric that could be measured by like some clever algorithm. Ethics requires looking at people in the entirety of their social relations.
And that requires a qualitative engagement with that entire context.
Mm-hmm.
And as you say, the Silicon Valley approach, the effective altruist approach, is one of pure abstract calculation. Let's just count up the points this decision gets
exactly.
Versus that.
It really is sort of like a game.
Yeah, it's like a video game. And that's wrong. It's offensively wrong to reduce human life or ecological life even to some linear algebra. And yet, as you say, that is exactly what they're doing, and they're asking us to hand over the entire economic and political landscape to them because they believe they're the smartest guys in the room, which is not. And I kind of wish we had a committee of Malagasy people to advise us, because their perspective is so much more aligned with how reality actually works.
Yeah.
And how human society, human relationships. Anyway, you're making a point throughout the book that it's all about relationship. As you write, morality is about social relationships. And later in the book, you write that values do not exist in isolation. So here we have this idea, which I agree with, that in order to have a substantive conversation about morality or ethics, as we're using and being affected by these new digital systems, we have to inquire about the relationships that are at play. And here's the twist, Webb. The twist, and you refer to this in the book, is that Silicon Valley increasingly wants us to have a certain kind of relationship with its products. We see this almost every day in the news headlines about people relating, usually unhealthily, to chatbots. So OpenAI and Google and other big tech companies have these LLM chatbot services where they'll pretend to be your friend, your girlfriend, your whatever, and they're asking the user to build a trusting relationship with this pile of linear algebra. You have this very pithy quote I liked a lot that expresses the challenge in a sentence. You write, "The challenge that quasi-human devices, that is, robots, avatars, and so on, the challenge that quasi-human devices pose is not because they are becoming human, but because they are designed to get us to see them as human." That's exactly right. They're not becoming human. That's clear. Linear algebra is never going to become human. It's not even going to become sentient. The reality, though, is that these companies are baking the deception into these platforms to make us think that they're becoming human or quasi-human or sentient in order for us to hand over more of our trust to these companies' products.
So that's exactly right. And this is, of course, the business model. The business model is essentially not dissimilar to that developed by the social media in earlier iterations, Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and so forth, which is essentially it's a form of addiction for many people, but it is essentially a reward system that keeps you clicking. I mean, it's actually not unlike the slot machines in Vegas, for that matter. Chatbots are designed to be sycophants. They're designed to tell you what you want to hear. They're designed to agree with you. Now, there have been some attempts to sort of tinker with the design to make them less obviously sycophantic, but that's going to be hard to do in any serious way because this is the business model. They're designed to get people to accept them because they tell people what they want to hear. You know, one way we might think about the famous phenomenon of so-called hallucinations is actually based on this. They're not really hallucinations, because a hallucination is when someone believes something is true that is not true. But in fact, AI has no notion of truth. It doesn't know anything about the world. It knows a lot about statistical relations among linguistic units. But leaving that aside, you might ask, why does the chatbot hallucinate? Because it's programmed to give you an answer when you want an answer. And if it doesn't know, it's going to say something anyway. You know, it's like the guy who doesn't know the direction to the place you want to go, but doesn't want to disappoint you by saying, "I don't know." So it's going to tell you something and lead you down the wrong road. And this is fundamental to the Silicon Valley business model. All the tinkering in the world, I think, can't get rid of it, because it's too baked, as you say, baked in. The whole operation as essentially a business operation. At the end of the day, it is a business operation. I mean, these are not benevolent gods who are, you know, bestowing upon us the fruits of their brilliance. These are people who need to make money.
And we're back. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host. We're halfway through my interview with Webb Keene, author of the book Animals, Robots, Gods, Adventures in the Moral Imagination. If you're interested in links to the book and Webb's page at University of Michigan and other resources, you can go to the Tectonic website, which is tectonic.fm. That's T-E-C-H tonic.fm. And you can find today's playlist by going to that site and just finding the Webb Keene episode and clicking the playlist link. Let's go ahead now and listen to the second half of my interview with Webb Keene here on Tectonic. Later in that chapter about quasi-humans, you write about robots taking on new roles as the technology advances. There is a section in the chapter about Japan and its general acceptance of robots in the home more than we might find in other countries like the U.S. So, for example, the idea that you could have a robotic servant in the home is more accepted in Japanese culture. And there are senior centers and elder care centers that are using robotic pets, like these robotic seals, for the elderly patients to, I'm using air quotes, relate to. Let me read you a passage from the book as you're writing about these robotic pets. You're talking about another writer named Robert Sparrow. In Robert Sparrow's view, in order to enjoy a robot pet, at some level of awareness, you have to mistake it for a real animal. This, Sparrow insists, is sentimentality of a morally deplorable kind. It's deplorable because we have a moral duty to see reality as it is. Since these machines are designed to delude us, it follows that they are unethical. I underlined that passage and wrote in my annotation, 100% agree. And you go on to say, as one moral philosopher suggests, if an old person is really attached to her robot pet, we should be thinking about the quality of their relationship, not whether the robot itself is immoral. You didn't quite come out and give your position, but you are giving some different ways, which I appreciate, of looking at this challenge of robot pets for the elderly. I want to hear your response, but I'm going to broaden this from elderly users to kids who are now being subjected to AI-infused toys increasingly. But first, let's talk about elders with robot pets. What do you think, Webb, about, you know, these robotic seals in nursing homes? Is that okay, or is it, as Robert Sparrow suggests, immoral simply because of the delusion that's built into the robot?
So, you know, there's a story that President Harry Truman once said, you know, whenever I ask my economists for advice, they say, well, on the one hand and on the other hand, I want someone to find me a one-armed economist. It's as an anthropologist, I find myself in the same situation because, at one level, yes, I agree with you that there's something very disturbing about people forming relations with what Robert Sparrow was talking about. I think it was not just old people. It was just sort of regular folks who had enjoyed having robot pet dogs. And in fact, when the dogs finally break down, there's a Buddhist temple that will perform mortuary ceremonies for the robot pet dogs. So that's, on the one hand, yes, this is disturbing if it really is a form of delusion. We certainly know of cases, even before AI and robotics, of children, you know, young people and adolescents forming truly delusional relations with characters in video games and in computer games and so forth. So on the other hand, I'd have to ask you whether you've ever cried at a movie or ever been so entranced with the characters in a novel that when you finish the novel, you feel a little bereft, like you miss your friends. Yeah, well, let's just take those two examples. If people are really deluded into thinking their robot pets are real animals and not robots, we got a problem here. But it's not necessarily the case. any more than someone who has just, finished, I don't know, Anna Karenina by Tolstoy and just feels, oh my God, these people are so real for me. And I'm sorry the book is over. I remember being terrified by the monkeys in Wizard of Oz. Even to this day, I can't like watch a rerun for the umpteenth time, Casablanca, and get a tear in my eye at the end of the movie, Am I deluded? Do I think that, Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman are real people? The characters that Rick and whatever her name is are real people? No, because I know it's fiction. What fiction allows us to do is, in some sense, temporarily suspend disbelief, enter into another kind of reality, and entertain alternative possibilities. But what's crucial here is that we know it's fiction. And the danger here is not that people enter into these relationships, but they don't understand the nature of the relationship. So I think we have to be very clear about the distinction between having a real relationship with a fictional character, and it is a real relationship, but I know the character is fictional, to having a real relationship with a character whose true nature I don't fully understand. And I think that's the distinction I think that Professor Sparrow is sort of missing out on the.
Yeah.
And so I think that there's certain forms of relationships with chatbots that can be productive, that can be healthy, that can be useful for people who perhaps are in really certain kinds of desperate psychological situations, for example, where they might be useful. But it's important that it not cross over into the line of delusion. And I think that's a distinction I think it's worth keeping in mind when we, again, my first response is to say, oh my God, that's terrible. And then I think, well, was it terrible that I, cried at a movie?
Well, okay, you said a lot. I like that answer. First of all, Casablanca as a work of art is designed, if we could say it that way, or it's staged and written and acted in a way to elicit an emotional response. That's the purpose of that work of art. And so if you had some sort of response, a tear in your eye, then that's part of what makes it a classic movie. Similarly for Anna Karenina and paintings and other novels and movies. None of those are telling you that they're real in the sense that you have entered into their world and they're actual real live human characters. That's the difference I see with chatbots and some of where we're headed with robots is that the companies want us, and eventually they will need us to believe that they are in some way sentient, because that will force us to fully give in and be fully manipulable to the company's aims. Now, I think there's a continuum from, if we just look at the age of the users who are being handed these robotic toys, let's put them in three categories. Okay, we have the very young, the kids who are using an AI Barbie, playing with an AI Barbie. Then we have people in the middle, homeowners who are, let's say, middle-aged, who have a robot dog. And then we have the very old who are in a senior center who might be at an age where they're losing some cognitive capacity. I would treat those three categories totally differently. For the elders, how many of us have been around a very old person who has a false memory of something and says something that claims that they did something that they never did? Who's going to correct the elder? Let them live in peace and have that hallucination. There's nothing wrong with that. So maybe in some limited circumstances, there could be some interaction with robotic pets. Of course, the danger there is that if robotic pets become normalized, that pulls the humans out of the context, and then no one has any human caregivers at all, which is the full dystopia that Silicon Valley would love to see. But let's leave that there. Now let's go to the other side of the spectrum, the kids. These kids are being handed AI-enabled toys, these dolls that the toy companies say will build a healthy relationship with the child, which is unhealthy in all sorts of respects. The child is not old enough to understand that this is not actually a sentient personality, and normalizing that for the raising of kids is just a terrible idea on every level, every dimension, except for the profits for those toy companies and their Silicon Valley partners. A lot of this comes back to what the incentives are for the companies baked into these things, rather than the, you know, the abstract idea of can we relate to a disembodied digital personality.
Well, again, I think that, you know, we need to be make distinctions. For example, children grow, you know, it's perfectly healthy for children, for example, to have imaginary playmates. So, you know, is there something inherently bad about these relationships? Well, that depends. And a lot of it has to do, again, with the business model, which I think is you're right to push on. What are the perverse incentives and where are they going to lead? So there's sort of two dangers in relationships to, let's say, chatbots and to robotic, they're sort of AI-powered robotic devices. There's sort of two general dangers that I see. And in some sense, they push in opposite directions. So let me backtrack and say one of the themes that runs through the book is that we can't understand what's new about artificial intelligence and LLMs in particular and robots. We can't understand what's new about them unless we recognize what's not new. So we need to be able to sort out those aspects of what's going on now that are in fact repeating very old patterns that humans have been working through over, you know, the course of human history. And that's where the anthropological perspective, I think, becomes very useful, because we have this very broad perspective. One of the things that is not new is that people anthropomorphize. When your car breaks down, you're not mentally ill if for momentarily you say, "Why are you doing this to me?" This is not a sign of delusion, but it is a natural response. If you think your dog is, you know, having thoughts about you, you know, this is probably actually objectively incorrect, but it is not crazy. Okay. And in fact, there's a animal trainer that I, whose work I draw on in the book, who says, in fact, being able to anthropomorphize dogs and horses is crucial to being able to work with them productively. So anthropomorphizing, projecting human qualities on the things that are not human is not in and of itself, it's certainly not new. And it's also not inherently bad or wrong or mistaken. So part of what we're seeing now are sort of these really remarkable new forms of anthropomorphism that are actually, these devices like robots and artificial intelligence are designed to prompt. They're designed to get us to anthropomorphize them. You know, this is, of course, what the Turing test was all about, was what would it take for a computer program to get me to respond to it as if it were a person? Alan Turing was already visualizing, you know, playing with this idea back in the 1950s. And we're there now. You know, we've got to that point. You quite rightly say, if we get persuaded that these devices are sentient, we're in trouble. And that is so part of the, so I mentioned before, I was starting to say that there are sort of two opposed risks that I see. And that is one of them. That is to say that we will grant too much authority to AI. You know, I mentioned earlier the way in which algorithms essentially by outsourcing judgment by persuading us that the algorithm is more objective than we are, is essentially a way of, that we grant authority to this technology. But when we grant authority to technology, at the end of the day, we're granting that authority to the people who own that technology, who are profiting from it. So that's a real danger, that we're granting authority to something that we shouldn't be granting authority to. And in the process of doing, that is to say, these devices, and in the process, we're also granting authority to the corporations that profit from them. That's the one danger. There's a second danger, which is moves in the other direction. And here I'm thinking about, back to your example of young children, which is, and we're likely to see this, we see this in the sycophanty, in the sort of the chatbot that is a sycophant tells me what I want to hear. And I think we see even more in certain kinds of robotic developments. And that is the idea that there might be something out there that I have complete and total power over, that I am in fact a master and it is my slave. So now we have sort of an opposite danger, which is what is it doing to me if I get used to being able to command something and that it will unquestioningly accept my commands? That's a danger too. You know, I have a colleague who told me a wonderful story. He had a young kid who had trouble going to sleep. So they had an Alexa installed in his room that he could then, that it would keep the lights on. And then when he asked Alexa to turn off the lights, Alexa would turn off the lights. And my friend said he overheard his son saying to the Alexa, please turn off the lights. And when it did so, then saying, thank you. Now, my friend thought first, oh, that's weird because it's just a device. Why is he being polite to it? Then he thought, that's really good. He knows that when you interact with something that responds like a human, this is how you should treat human beings. But of course, eventually that kid might grow up to be someone who realizes, actually, I don't have to say please and thank you to Alexa. I can just give commands. I can just give orders. Would that then become the model for how you interact with other human beings? So that's the danger, the dangers of anthropomorphism that push in two ways. And one is projecting human qualities onto devices, and the other is projecting our understanding of technology back onto humans and treating humans as if they were devices. It can cut both ways. I think we've got actually both risks are at play right now.
And underlying the whole thing is, as you say, the incentives for the corporations to make us more and more dependent on these systems, however we relate to them. But as you point out repeatedly in the book, these relationships, if you can call it that, only go as far as we let them. In a later section of the book, you're talking about AI as a pseudo-divine or godlike presence, and you write, AI is only as godlike as people make it so. And I thought that was such a good lesson for the whole book. These systems only go as far as we let them, and for anybody who wants to resist, that's really good news because we do have some autonomy left to say no or draw boundaries and say, I'm not relating to this thing beyond this point. But overall, I think these are really important questions and topics for us to wrestle with. In your conclusion, I thought you had a good summation of this. You write, the more that AI-driven systems take charge of making decisions about people's lives, in hiring, policing, finance, medical care, and so forth, the more real becomes the problem of making machines moral. And a good place to start for anyone interested in this is to read this book. It's called Animals, Robots, Gods, Adventures in the Moral Imagination by you, Webb Keene, and published by Princeton University Press. Webb, we could have gone on much longer, but I hope you'll be back on the show sometime. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Mark. It's been a real pleasure.
And we're back. If you are just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the remaining several minutes of the show. We just heard my interview with Webb Keene, author of the new book, Animals, Robots, Gods, Adventures in the Moral Imagination, published by Princeton University Press. And I think you could tell I enjoyed the read, and I especially enjoyed speaking about the book with Webb, a great conversation with a lot of dimensions and depth, I guess. It's hard sometimes to decide where to limit or direct the conversation when I'm recording these interviews, because a book like this goes in so many different directions that I could have taken it. So I hope you found that to be an interesting introduction to the book, and that you will seek out the book if you're interested in reading more about ethics and our moral imagination as we go into these uncharted territories of AI and robots. I should say the book goes well beyond digital technology. There's a whole section on ethics and how we treat animals, and it gets into the idea in, as it's referred to in the title, gods. It gets into relations with items that have some divine or perceived divine nature. He gets into fetishes, that is to say, these religious devices from certain religions. Gets into speaking in tongues, also known as glossolalia, and this idea of possession. I mean, it really goes in many different directions, but it's tied together in the idea that human society has always engaged with questions of morality and ethics, with relations with non-human beings or perceived beings. And so the idea that we're being asked now to relate, in air quotes, with AIs and robots is not that unusual. It's happened before. In my opinion, as I pointed out in the interview, I think what is different here is that the companies are on the other side of that equation now, whereas they never were before. We now have five or six, depending on how you count, five or six companies that are enjoying an incredible concentration of power and wealth that we've never seen before, and they have a long track record of deception and exploitation. So the deck is stacked against anyone who agrees to enter into any kind of relationship with anything that comes out of these companies. We mentioned briefly in the interview this idea of AI-enabled toys, and on the playlist I've posted this article from the IEEE, August 21st, 2025. The headline is, "Could an AI Barbie stunt the emotional growth of a generation?" And this is an article that has to do with this new partnership between OpenAI and the world's largest toy maker, Mattel, or I should say toy company. And Mattel, of course, is the company behind Barbie as well as many other toy lines. And while there is no AI Barbie yet, as of when I'm speaking to you, it's a distinct possibility that at some point Mattel could launch an AI-enabled Barbie with the help of OpenAI and all of its chatbots. And so that gets into the questions that Webb and I were just talking about. What happens when we are allowing or even encouraging small children to form relationships with chatbots that are created and controlled by big tech companies with a long track record of everything I just said? And so this, I was glad to see this article from IEEE, which says, quote, "Children, especially in early developmental stages, are acutely sensitive to tone, timing, and emotional mirroring. Children playing with AI toys will believe they're being understood when in fact the system is only predicting plausible next words." And it goes on to talk about the documented mental health problems that chatbots are creating for a lot of adult users. We are just careening into this era of people using and relating to chatbots in ways that are just totally unchecked. There's no regulation, there are no guardrails, and it doesn't look like there's any control coming from our current government anytime soon. And so the big tech companies are just sitting there accountability free as users are going into these deep and sometimes unhealthy relationships with chatbots, as the article says, sometimes triggering mental health crises or reinforcing false beliefs or dangerous ideas. OpenAI continues, to its credit, has hired forensic psychiatrists to study how ChatGPT affects users emotionally, but should we really be exposing children to it? I think the answer to that is an obvious no, but I think it also it doesn't practically matter very much because these companies have no checks on their power or their decision-making at the moment. Maybe it'll come at some point. But this idea of thinking about the ethics and morality of our potential relationships with these new tools is very important. And kids potentially relating in the future to an AI Barbie is just one of the many outcomes. As I said at the end to Webb, I appreciated that his book pointed out the outcomes in policing and employment and finance and healthcare and education that all come from these algorithms that are not developed by some disembodied AI in a cloud somewhere. These are all coded by human beings. Human beings sitting in cubicles, many of them in Silicon Valley, and they have their own perspective from being employees of big tech companies. And they're being forced to do things, I think, in some cases that they don't want to do. They probably know that some of these things are unethical, but that's what they're being paid for, and so they do it anyway. That's a particular perspective of the tools that forces these decisions on the rest of us. And that's why it's so important for us to talk about where we're headed. Interesting that Webb Keene brought up effective altruism, which came up just recently in my interview with Adam Becker, if you wanted to go back and listen to that interview. And there was another interesting connection with a past Tectonic guest. A couple of years ago, Webb Keene wrote an op-ed in The Spectator in the UK, co-authored with Scott Shapiro, who's at Yale and is a past Tectonic guest. This op-ed is called Why We Should Fear the AI Godbot. This is another reflection on the gods part of the title, this idea that AIs can be perceived as divine or godlike in some way, even though they clearly are not. And just one excerpt from that op-ed makes the case that it's really, again, it's all about the humans behind the AIs. They write, AI is made by humans and can be constrained by humans. We should not give AI divine authority over human dilemmas. Humans are morally accountable for their actions. As agonizing as some ethical issues are, we cannot outsource them to snippets of code. AI will only become godlike if we make it so. And that brings me to my final thought, friends, which is that as these big tech companies are encoding their decisions, their biases, their worldview, their exploitative desires into their code, and that is rolled out to affect all of us, we, the rest of us, we still have some agency. We get to decide, in some cases, whether we are going to relate to those disembodied chatbot personalities as sentient beings, as beings that are worthy of any kind of relationship. As for me, I'm not going to, if I can help it. I'm not going to relate to a chatbot. I may occasionally use some chat interface if I have to, or if there's some particular question that I think it can answer quickly, get a quick utilitarian response out of it, okay. But as for developing a relationship, this is the phase, this is the next phase that big tech really wants to bring us to. As for developing a relationship with these things, as though they are our friends, as though they are our pets, as though they are the toys that we need to be talking to and learning from, as though they are gods. These are all the aims of these companies, because that's where the money lies. If you can get people hooked on human-level relationships with snippets of code, then you really got good margins coming at you. And that's what we can refuse. We can refuse to see these things as beings worthy of our relationships. We can refuse. We can resist. Use them if we must and be affected by them, perhaps. It may be unavoidable, but we can know for ourselves these are just algorithms. They are not alive, and they are built out of the decisions of actual humans with their own agenda in Silicon Valley that is not in our best interest. We can resist, friends. And I hope you'll join me in doing that. Hope you found something interesting and enlightening in today's episode. Thanks again for joining me. You are listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County, and 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. Check the playlist for lots of trolley memes at tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. And until next time, friends, you know what to do. Avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, get off Google. And hey, speaking of trolleys, let's go out to Timothy Clover's song, Trolley Car Line. I'll see you next time, friends.
How would you like to ride on my trolley car line? Come along with me, sit back and find your man. Trolley cars and candy bars, a lot of pop man coming through your door. Flowers and balloons on sale from the sidewalk.
The greatest 38 seconds of music ever recorded, possibly. 5% for Nothing. I never announced that song. My opening theme is 5% for Nothing by Yes off the Fragile album. 38 seconds of music composed by drummer Bill Bruford. Good evening. My name is Dave Mandel, and I am the host of this program, which is called It's Complicated, an hour of Prague and Prague-adjacent music. I'm here every Monday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern Time here at WFMU. Thrilled always to be sitting in this chair playing music for you. A lot of really, really good music for you tonight. I mean, all those other weeks I was just kind of toying with you. Tonight I break out the good stuff. Lots of it, or an hour of it. We're going to start with something from a band called Gargantua, which is a
name I like.
Named after the character from the great Rabelais novels. And they were Polish. And the track I'm going to play, the album I'm going to play, or the track from the album, the album from which I'm going to play a track with, is from 2007. It sounds more vintage, but it's fairly recent, 2007. And not much I can tell you. The album's called Kota Garda, undoubtedly some Polish word that I have no clue about. Really great stuff. This is the band Gargantua.
Zit!
And that's music from the group. Hold on a second while I move my microphone. Oh, that's so much better. Music from the group Gargantua, Polish prog band, orchestral prog, I guess we can call them, from a track from an album called Kota Garda from 2007. I'm not going to attempt the track title. Really great album that I was finally, after several attempts, able to get my hand on a copy of recently. All right, we are now going to go to Italy, and here's something from a group called Orchestra SMS, and they